Since she won the Linbury Prize for Design in 1995, Es Devlin has won a host of awards and much acclaim for her international stage and costume design. Opera, Salome at the Royal Opera House, for example, theatre, the recent Master and Margarita, dance and concerts for Kanye West, the Pet Shop Boys and Lady Gaga, to name but a few. And now she's designing the closing ceremony of the Olympic Games. Actually, Es, you went to the academy when you were quite young, didn't you?
Yes, every Saturday I would get on the train to come to the junior exhibitioners' classes at the Royal Academy, and I would play the clarinet and the piano.
So music's been in your life quite a while?
Always. And I think my parents felt that it was something that was going to be central to my life, and they took that step. I was keen to go to a school that was all about music. I wanted to go to Cheetham's in Manchester, but in the end we settled for just going up at the weekends. And it was an extraordinary experience to be wandering through these corridors where you would hear little fragments of everybody playing their instruments, and that stayed with me.
Do you think that that exposure to playing an instrument has been quite helpful in what you've gone on to do in your professional career?
I'd say it's been fundamental, and I'd say as an act of education, there's nothing more important than teaching music, because I think from music you glean mathematics, you glean, with the study of the lyrics to songs and to opera, you glean a sense of language and poetry, and then when you're researching an opera, you a sense of history and social context. And of course, the act of expression at that age is incredibly important. So yes, absolutely central.
And we know that, for instance, with children who have brain problems, that music often gets through where other things can't. So that there's a kind of ability to communicate at a very fundamental level.
And it's applicable. I mean, I went on to study language. I went on to study English literature. And certainly my approach was very much to seek out the music within language, seek out the rhythms, especially in the spoken word, in the performed word. So that became very much part of my practice as a designer for drama.
In fact, that training, that interest in literature, very much informs the first piece of music you've chosen.
Indeed, it's from A Midsummer Night's Dream, from Benjamin Britten's setting of the piece. I was thinking, actually, of just playing a spoken recital of the text, but then I remembered that this really is the ultimate. So, yes, I'm looking forward to hearing this now.
But the things that you find in it, the different ways in which we can understand the meaning of the word time, for example.
I think that's right. And I think when Shakespeare's audience first heard this play, they would never have seen it on a page. So the homophone of time, you know, is it the herb, is it time, as we understand it, would have been playing multiple levels in their minds as they heard the word. They wouldn't have seen it written. They wouldn't have known that it's locked down by its spelling into the one meaning. And I think the act of listening to a Shakespeare play at the Globe Theatre, the audience members become stage designers at one level, designing parallel images as the homophones come one after the other. And in a speech like this, they're coming thick and fast, and it's quite an intoxicating experience for the mind just to be forming these multiple images one after another.
Welcome, wanderer! Hast thou the flower there?
Music from Act One of Benjamin Britten's A Midsummer Night's Dream. We heard James Bowman with the City of London Sinfonia, conducted by Richard Hickox. The next music, I think you... Well, we're going to hear Kate Bush later herself, but this was through another of her tracks that you investigated this music.
In 1989, I would have been 18, and it seems suddenly this quality of sound from Le Mystère de Voix Bulgare, these Bulgarian choirs, it was the television choir from Bulgaria. This was a sound world I had never heard before, and suddenly it was everywhere. Suddenly Kate Bush was using it. It was in Denis Arcand's film Jesus of Montreal. There was music similar to it in the fabulous film Le Temps des Gitanes. And I wanted to talk about this because, in a way, my response to it is the inverse of my response to text, to Shakespeare. I don't know what the words mean. I am responding purely, viscerally, with a part of me that bypasses my conscious brain. And as stage designers, this is part of our practice as well, to allow the music to bypass the conscious and speak very much to a profound place.
It's an enthralling sound, isn't it? The Bulgarian voices that was recorded in Sofia in 1982, Le Mystère des Voix Bulgares, and the piece was called Teasing. It's a traditional piece. When you hear something like that, it has a kind of enormously earthy quality, doesn't it? It sounds, I mean, because it's sort of folk music, but as with so many things, a certain degree of precision is required to make something actually sound very primitive and even frenetic.
I think the quality of voices together, as you say, the precision of these dissonances and harmonies at the same time. Everybody should sing in a choir every day, frankly, shouldn't they? I feel very privileged that in rehearsals at the Opera House, I'm able to sit in a room with 100 people singing at once in harmony. And the response is physical. It does resonate through your body. And certainly whenever I listen to this, I am literally vibrating that sound.
Could we approach this next piece as from the point of view of how you saw it? Because I was very touched by the way humanity, in a sense, moved around what you had created in your description.
The next piece is the Verwandlungsmusik from Wagner's Parsifal. And to me, this is probably one of the most consummate achievements of a man writing music. This interlude takes place in Act One during the scene change between Scene One and Two. And I can't hear this piece of music without crying. I think that's quite a common response to it, actually. The piece is about compassion, Mitleid. It's about looking at humanity from some kind of distance.
It's about the eternal wound of humanity.
Indeed. It expresses eternal pain. You view it from this distance, and yet you are within it, and you are accepting of your place within it. And we have just put on a production of Parsifal at the Royal Danish Opera.
With Keith Warner.
With Keith Warner directing. And we envisaged this particular section. We created an enormous tower, a sort of 19th century black brick tower, an edifice, like a giant chess piece, a rook. It's lying down on its side. It's churning around in a 360-degree, slow, laborious turn. There are little humans beneath it, travelling in crisscrossing circles, a procession of Buddhists, a procession of Christians following the cross. And as one watches this and listens to this heart-wrenching, I think, music, one feels this profound sense of compassion for these humans desperately trying to hold on to a sense of meaning in ritual, which has been done so many times that people have perhaps lost sense of what the ritual was supposed to mean in the first place.
Thank you.
I think the extraordinary thing about Parsifal is that even if you had not a clue what it was about, if you'd come from Mars, you'd sit there in tears because of the sheer conviction and power of it. And it's so fascinating how great innovative artists go back to earlier models. In other words, that even the people who seem to create their own language, actually everything in one sense is an extension of something that's happened before. And there are sort of Bach-like suspensions in that passage.
Yes, I mean, it's that great march of culture. We stand on the shoulders, certainly.
We heard the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra conducted with considerable muscularity, as one might expect, by James Levine, the Verwandlungsmusik from Parsifal Act 1 by Wagner. Now, Stefan, the words to our next piece, I think, intrigue you almost as much as the Shakespeare we heard in A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yes, we're going to listen to Kanye West and Jay-Z's version of Diamonds Are Forever. They call it Diamonds from Sierra Leone, the Shirley Bassey. The rap form, the rap genre, can be misunderstood. It's really important, I think, to find within the great mass of rap music, which is incredibly popular, to find the people who really are the masters of the form. And because I work with it, I study it. So the first time Kanye West approached me and said, will you design my concert? I downloaded all his lyrics. That was my libretto. I studied it in detail. I looked up all the references. I made sure I understood what he was saying. And it repays this study. Not all pop lyrics do repay such study. It does. And you'll find when you listen to this, there are certain lyrics that come up that if you don't know what they refer to, it's hard to get a sense of the song. But Kanye and Jay-Z can expect their audience to know, when they say the word Jacob, their audience will know that Jacob's the jeweler who makes the insignia, the medallions, the rites of passage medals that rappers wear. When they say chain and gang, they'll understand that the gang is the group who are part of Rockefeller Records, the record label, and they'll understand that the chain is, again, the thing that you get when you join the record label. They'll make those connections. So I think there is a connection with Shakespeare's audience. Shakespeare knew that he could rely on his audience to get certain connections.
And also that the diamonds that come from somewhere, in a way, where people profoundly exploited.
Well, this is the interesting thing, is that Kanye didn't know this when he first recorded this song. He had no clue about what was going on in Sierra Leone and that there are warlords who are funded by the sale of so-called conflict blood diamonds. He was made aware of this by the producers working with him on the song. So he then rewrote the song with Jay-Z and wrote totally new lyrics to it. And a whole mass of people who probably knew nothing about this issue but were Kanye West fans became aware. So
diamonds are forever. They are all I need to please me. They can stimulate and tease me. They won't leave in the night. I've no fear that they might desert me. Diamonds are forever.
Throw your diamonds in the sky if you feel the vibe. The rock is still alive every time I rhyme. Forever, ever, forever, ever, 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 ever. Good morning, this ain't Vietnam still. People lose hands, legs, arms for real. Little was known of Sierra Leone and how it connects to the diamonds we own. When I speak of diamonds in this song, I ain't talking about the ones to be cloned. I'm talking about Rockefeller, my home, my chain. These ain't conflict diamonds. Is they Jacob? Don't lie to me, man. See a part of me saying, keep shining. How? When I know what a blood diamonds. Though it's thousands of miles away, Sierra Leone connect to what we go through today. Over here, it's the drug trade. We die from drugs. Over there, they die from what we buy from drugs. The diamonds, the
the chains, the braces, the charms is. I thought my Jesus piece was so harmless, till I seen a picture of a shorty armless. And here's the conflict, it's in a black person's soul to rock that gold. Spend your whole life trying to get that ice. On a polo rugby, you look so nice. How can something so wrong make me feel so right, right? Before I beat myself up like Ike, you can still throw your rocker for the diamond tonight. Because throw your diamonds in the sky if you feel the vibe. The rock is still alive every time I rhyme. Forever, ever, forever, ever, 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 ever.
What's your visual reaction to that? How do you deal with it?
Well, that's an interesting question. I've been working with Kanye since 2005, and we've never done it the same way twice. When you're working with an artist like that, it's about constant reinvention. So really the key to it is to try and keep up with his range of reference, because it's fast and it'll change every week.
In a way, your designs make the most of the way the technology has developed in the last 10, 20 years. Is that fair to say?
I have found that working in pop music, because things are quick, things happen really fast, that world requires a visual per second. You know, when you are looking at a 3-minute Rihanna performance on the Brit Awards, it's visual ideas per second. That has made me very aware of duration. I went to see the Philip Glass Einstein on the Beach recently, and he picks up where John Cage left off, the 4 minutes, 33 seconds of silence. It's about the ideas per second that an audience are going to sit through for 5 hours. So yes, this has brought to my practice a precision and a detail, I think.
Diamonds from Sierra Leone, Kanye West featuring Jay-Z doing the remix, and of course the original music of Diamonds Are Forever, John Barry and Shirley Bassey. To go to the other end of the territory, except in a way they all cross over, but I was going to say, you came to your next project as Devlin, I imagine, informed by your early exposure to Euripides.
Indeed, we're going to listen to an extract from Les Troyens, Berlioz's epic opera, and I designed Hecuba, Euripides Hecuba, for the Royal Shakespeare Company a number of years ago. And once you enter that Greek tragedy territory, nothing's the same again afterwards. And Berlioz, from a child, was steeped in this. He was, you know, obsessed with Virgil's Aeneid, obsessed also, of course, with Shakespeare. And the vision that he has in this piece is, I think, terrifying, as is Euripides' vision in Hecuba, that war is eternal. The instinct towards war and towards conflict is endless.
And that has, well, unfortunately been borne out by time, hasn't it?
Indeed.
So what are we going to hear?
We're going to hear the Marche Troyenne, the end of Act One, where finally they bring the horse into the walls of Troy, and Cassandra has been begging them not to. And what's extraordinary, what fascinates me about this particular extract, is that Berlioz, years before Kanye's arsenal of gadgets in a recording studio enabling him to create space and placement within a track, Berlioz is doing this literally spatially on the stage of the theatre. So he places his chorus way off stage, as far as he possibly physically can put them, and he puts the mezzo Cassandra right downstage, and you get this fabulous vista, this epic sense of literal space in the music.
Thank you.
Marche Troyenne, music from Les Troyennes, Act 1 by Berlioz. We heard Petra Lang singing Cassandre with the London Symphony Orchestra and Choir, conducted by that great Berlioz specialist, Sir Colin Davis. As having talked to you now and having seen your work, I'm not surprised that you should be an aficionado of Kate Bush, although that obviously went back to your teenage years. because she's somebody who works with enormous precision, and everything she does is very carefully sculpted and thought out, as well as having a kind of visionary touch to it and that extraordinary voice.
So we're going to listen to The Man with the Child in His Eyes, and the extraordinary thing, you touch on her precision, is not long ago the handwritten lyrics to this song became available at auction. I think one of her first boyfriends was selling them. And she writes this. She's, you know, 14 years old. She's in love. She has a pink biro. She does little circles for her eyes. And she writes the text out in this beautiful little handwriting. And she's singing in your ear. She's telling you her story. It's a simple story. She's 14 and she's in love. But already the epic ambition and intention is there. So the production around this is orchestral. It's symphonic. It's huge. And I was listening to this when I was 14, and it meant everything to me at the time.
I hear him before I go to sleep and focus on the day that's been. I realize he's there when I turn the light off and turn off.
You never quite know what she's going to do harmonically. I mean, even that chord that she ended on could have resolved up to a sort of major chord, a tone up, and it actually just stops there because it's what she wants to do. Kate Bush, The Man with the Child in His Eyes. I'm glad, Estepan, that you're as keen as I am on Janáček. And I find in his operas that quality that we were talking about with the Bulgarian singers, that extraordinary, earthy, motivic writing, which is so informed by the language stress of Czech.
This is right at the end of Yennefer. His son has already died. His daughter is incredibly ill. She will die before this piece is performed. And he's writing a story, almost, I call it almost a kitchen sink opera, in the way that Ibsen was very shockingly and for the first time in this period, exposing ordinary, daily, sordid tales on the stage in drama. Here he is, it's an opera in prose, these are ordinary people. She's a single mother. She's suffered GBH. She's been slashed.
It's sort of Wozzeck-like in a way.
Indeed. And at the end, it couldn't be bleaker. She's been abandoned by the father of her child. Her mother, for all the best intentions in the world, we like to consider, has killed this child to give her the best chance. And now, on her wedding day with Latsa, the cousin who's always been besotted by her and has gashed her face, their wedding day is happening. They're in this small village. The baby's body's been discovered under the melting ice. And everyone turns on her. And finally, the Kostelnica admits that she's the one who killed the baby, and they're left alone, Latsa and Yennefer, to start their life. And like Parsifal, it's about compassion. You've lived with these people for 3 hours, this duration of time that we have spent in their company, in the opera. And they accept each other, and somehow one feels, in spite of the bleakness of everything, that they'll probably be okay.
Right, it's a radiant ending. It's not a gloom-tinged ending. And there we had Colin Davis for Berlioz, and we had the great Janáček conductor Charles Mackerras conducting the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra there with Elisabeth Söderström and Vítislav Ochman in Odeslí from Yennefer by Janáček. You mentioned earlier, Esteban, John Cage, and rather bizarrely, our next pianist, great jazz pianist, found himself working on a prepared piano in this instance.
This is the Cologne concert, Keith Jarrett. And what I find fascinating about this is that it's the product of a very particular and seemingly inconsequential set of circumstances. So the story goes that a very young German producer, 17 years old, working at the Opera House, found an 11 p.m. slot and said, let's have this jazz concert, which was unheard of at the time. Apparently, they had never had a jazz concert at the Opera House. And Keith Jarrett turned up. He was tired. He hadn't slept. He'd been on a long flight. The Bösendorfer piano was not there that he had requested. Some other Bösendorfer piano was there. It wasn't a full grand. It was a baby grand. The pedals didn't work quite right. Some of the higher registers weren't sounding as they should. He tried to pull out. The 17-year-old producer, by all accounts, insisted that he do this concert. And therefore, he used the pedals in a certain way. Therefore, he played certain parts of the piano in a certain way. And therefore, we have this extraordinary recording, which wasn't even transcribed for years and years to come. It only existed as this captured moment of time.
Thank you.
I guess he must have been quite pleased with the results himself to allow it to be put on a CD, because most artists, if they didn't think the instrument was up to it. So he obviously felt that the piano spoke to him in some way.
I think, yes, he found his way.
Keith Jarrett, and that was part of part one from the Köln concert, recorded under those rather remarkable circumstances we heard about earlier. S. Devlin, the Nina Simone song we're going to hear next also has a rather extraordinary story surrounding it. It's a Bob Dylan number, but I think that when she was playing it on one occasion, her parents were moved to the back of the auditorium because, of course, they were black and the rest of the audience were white.
In fact, that happened when she was very young. She was 13, and it was actually not when she was singing this song, but when she was playing her first piano concert, because she trained as a classical pianist. And indeed, it was, you know, in the 40s, 50s in America, and they weren't white. They couldn't sit at the front. So she refused to start until her parents were moved to the front. So I'm interested in this. It's Bob Dylan's I Shall Be Released, sung by Nina Simone in 1969. I'm interested because it's a reinterpretation. It's what does it mean to Nina Simone to sing I Shall Be Released, black woman, in 1969? Many people have found their own meaning to the words I Shall Be Released. Elvis Presley, The Beatles, The Who. And it's what we do as opera stage designers. We reinterpret works which have been endlessly envisaged and re-envisaged.
What do you say to people who sometimes react to new productions and want to always to see a repetition of their old favourite comforting view of the piece?
The extraordinary thing is that I find those reactions incredibly rare. What I really enjoy about the audience to opera that I find out there is they come because they want to see the work envisioned by this group of people today. And it's extraordinary that we are allowed to really find our own ways through these pieces.
Y'all pushing, you're pushing. Just relax. You're pushing it. It'll go up by itself. Don't put nothing in it unless you feel it. Let's do it again, please. They say everything can be replaced. Near. So I remember every face of every man who put me here. I see my light come shine. Thank you.
yonder stands a man in this lonely crowd. Man who says he's not to blame.
Nina Simone and I Shall Be Released, the Bob Dylan number. Well, let's just finish then on what is going on today, in fact this evening, which is your designs for the Olympic closing ceremony. Tell me a little bit about it. What are we going to see? What does it all consist of?
Well, at 9 o'clock tonight, we will be ready to show you what we're calling a Symphony of British Pop. It's a celebration. These athletes have been working sometimes for years. There'll be 12,000 of them, we hope, in attendance. This is their party. This is the end of the event, their party. So everything about it for us, we wanted to celebrate. We wanted to celebrate what's great about British culture. And we went for pop culture. You know, the opening ceremony has touched on many other aspects of our culture, and we wanted to go purely for pop. So imagine a celestial radio that can only tune into British pop music from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, thousands, now. We will tune our way through fragments. It's through composed. It's not a one after the other pop concert.
And this is another James Bond composer that's been
working on. Yes, we have. David Arnold has curated it with us, and Kim Gavin is directing it. And we will weave our way through. You'll hear fragments, bridges, choruses, little fragments of songs that you'll recognise immediately from that fragment. And then we'll settle 5-minute segments on songs that hopefully everybody will
kind of
know and
ones.
Love. Absolutely, yeah.
And what have you done to go with this?
Again, celebrating pop culture. It's jubilant, colourful, pop-up. Pop art, fun and celebratory.
Well, we look forward to it very much. Thank you very much, Es Devlin. I can see why people enjoy working with you.
Thank you very much.
Es Devlin was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week at the same time on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the actress Miriam Margolyes. That's at midday next Sunday. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. The producer of today's programme was Sarah Cropper.
Life for young Europeans.
If you are caught sleeping in the public place, then you can be fined or you can go to prison. Basically, poverty is criminalized if you're homeless.
A generation fighting draconian legislation, rising poverty and corruption.
He's young, he's inexperienced, but that's a good thing because as he's inexperienced in politics, he doesn't know how to steal.
BBC Radio 4 spends a week with Generation E, starting on Monday at 1:45.
Well, if you've recently tuned in, welcome from me, Jonathan Swain. You're listening to BBC Radio 3 in a couple of minutes, today's early music show. As for the BBC Proms, well, we've toured them today. The second of them brings a rare performance of Schoenberg's medieval love tragedy, Gurrelieder. Jukka-Pekka Saraste conducts the BBC Symphony Orchestra and a choir of some 300 voices. The solo singers, including tenor Simon O'Neill as the cursed King Valdemar, with soprano Angela Gdenoke making her Proms debut. That's live from the Royal Albert Hall tonight here on Radio 3 at 8 p.m. Before then, we're live at the Hall this afternoon at 3:30 for a programme of woodwind and brass music. Vaughan Williams, Holst and Walton, played by the National Youth Wind Orchestra of Great Britain, and Gavin Bryars, George Benjamin and Derek Bourgeois, played by the National Youth Brass Band of Great Britain. 3:30 for that. It's now 1 o'clock and time for the news, read by Susan Ray.
David Cameron has welcomed what he called the enormous confidence boost given to Britain by the Olympics. The Labour leader, Ed Miliband, has spoken of a sense of pride. Both have suggested the national optimism could be used to help the country. The Prime Minister confirmed that the government had allocated an extra £80 million to fund Britain's top athletes until the 2016 Rio Games. Mr Cameron is hosting a conference at Downing Street this afternoon on tackling world hunger. Among those taking part is Kenya's Prime Minister, Raila Odinga. He said the spirit of the Olympic Games should be used as a springboard to tackle hunger, malnutrition and disease. It's been calculated that Britain will finish third in the medals table. Russia, which is in fourth position, cannot win enough golds now to overtake Team GB. Britain's final medal hopes are in boxing and the modern pentathlon. Police in South London investigating the disappearance of the 12-year-old Tia Sharp have charged her grandmother's boyfriend with her murder. Stuart Hazel, who's 37, is due in court tomorrow. Tia's grandmother and another man have been released on bail. Iran's interior minister says the number of people known to have died in two devastating earthquakes in the northwest of the country has been revised downwards, with 227 people killed. Nearly 1,400 others have been injured. Emergency teams are trying to help survivors in isolated villages. Police in Manchester are trying to trace a man wanted over a fatal grenade attack in the city. Dale Cregan, who's 29 and has a false eye, is thought to have been involved in two gun and grenade attacks in the city on Friday and an earlier fatal shooting. The man known as the voice of darts, the commentator Sid Waddell, has died at the age of 72. He'd been diagnosed with bowel cancer last September. The weather, it'll be largely fine, dry and warm across Scotland and most of northern and eastern England. Further south and west, it'll be cloudier with a scattering of heavy showers. And that's the BBC News and Weather at 1:02.
And it was read by Susan Ray. Time now on Radio 3 to join Lucy Skeeping for today's Early Music Show.
Thank you. lunchtime greetings. That was a toccata, a bit of a display piece played there on Renaissance wind instruments. And it not only fanfares the start of the programme, but also the 400th anniversary this month of its composer, who we're featuring today, Giovanni Gabrieli. The scene is Venice, where for 27 years until his death in 1612, Gabrieli lived and worked. And what a wonderful, prosperous place it was for musicians. There was music making in the ducal chapel, in the churches, the civic institutions, in the streets and in private houses. So any trained, polished instrumentalist or singer found himself well employed. But Venice wasn't just a great stomping ground for busy professionals. It also looked after its less fortunate citizens through its confraternities, or the scuole, or trade guilds that provided charity for the poor and the sick. These were also religious establishments, and so they too needed to call upon performers and composers for their regular masses and for the grand celebrations each year that marked their particular saint's day. One of the oldest of these confraternities, and certainly one of the richest in terms of its building and incredible artwork, was the Scuola di San Rocco. Almost wall to wall with Tintorettos and more besides, it's still one of Venice's main tourist attractions, situated within the S bend of the Grand Canal, just a short walk from St Mark's Cathedral. Nowadays, the narrow, winding route from one to the other is packed with shops and cafes. But more than four centuries ago, it must have been extremely well trodden by Gabrieli, because from 1585, he was the organist in both establishments. And since the same groups of players and singers often worked in several different churches, much as they might do today, Gabrieli, in the centre of it all, must have spent a good deal of his time making sure the right performers were booked for the right venue, turned up at the right time, and with the right music, not to mention the right instrument.